In contrast, when an employer had to pay workers for their labor rather than simply providing rations, a male laborer could receive up to 62.5 gallons of barley a month. Presumably, the worker could then sell or barter the excess food, and that could supplement his income. We see that those workers who were given rations could not command more in exchange for their work, and they were probably the lowest and most vulnerable members of society. So when we see a division by age, such as by the age of the children, and children as young as 5 are recorded in these ration lists, and the elderly, that there are these distinctions in what rations they receive, we also are reminded that the temple and the palace had this duty to provide food for their people. And the way that they did this was to put them to work and different tasks. We've seen how the temple and the king are ordered to supply food for their people, especially those who can't easily supply food for themselves. And there are also occasions when somehow the king could not supply food for his workers. And these don't receive much attention in the text because kings don't like to reveal their weaknesses. But we can identify certain periods of famine. And I think I mentioned one of these at the end of the Ur III dynasty. The last king, Ibbi-Sin, was facing a widespread famine in his kingdom. And he sent letters to a general, begging the general to send him food so that he could supply the people at Ur with bread. And he demanded the food at any price. So we get a sense that there were definitely times when there was inflation for the basic necessities of life. Another occasion that would cause a disruption of the food supply would be when cities were besieged. This is one of the drawbacks to city life, that when, as war increased in the second and first millennium, cities would more often be besieged by rulers who were trying to control a large territory. And so an army encamped around the city would prevent workers from going out to their fields, and any food that would supply those who were cooped up behind the city walls, protected by the walls, had to be brought in before the siege began. Eventually, the food will run out, in no small part because there were more people behind the city, depending on its protection. And so as we look at military records, we can usually figure out when the food, sometimes even water supply, ran out in a city. When Hammurabi was encamped around the city of Larsa, the siege lasted about 6 months before food ran out. And this would be the occasion of surrender of the city. This survey of food allows us to explore both the local and exotic resources that were available for the meals enjoyed in Mesopotamia. Sometimes when we think of the ancient world, we think that everyone was eating a sort of tasteless mush, a very bleak diet of barely cooked meat. But in fact, the texts let us imagine meals that were much closer to the reality of modern Middle Eastern dishes, with a lot of variety, different tastes and textures. We've also learned that food was a commodity exchanged for work or as a treat given by a ruler to his people on the occasion of a banquet. It could also be the weak link in a defense of the city when a city was under siege. I'd like you to keep in mind the image of the city and daily life that we've been creating over the past couple of lectures. Now, as we move back to a more historical narrative. In the next lecture, we will begin by a focus on a specific aspect of the Assyrian economy, the merchants who helped create and expand a wide and thriving trade network in northern Mesopotamia. And then we will start to look at the first hints of the Assyrian military strength that appears for the first time at the end of the second millennium.